In an ever-changing world, Life Changes Network presents A Voice of Truth and Inspiration, broadcasting on the frequencies of love, laughter, and understanding, illuminating new paths for new directions, and on a mission to inspire humanity in embracing, honoring, and engaging the changes going on in ourselves, in our lives, and in our world. As we, as one, strive for higher and higher planes of existence, always remembering life changes. This is radio like you've never felt before. Life changes. And now your host, our MC, our master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
Thank you for that, Mark. Life changes. Life changes. And it does. It's changing all the time. And you know, the interesting thing is, no, I won't tell you what the interesting things you'll have to figure out on your own. No, actually, before I say that, I just wanted to remind everybody that our guest tonight that we're really happy to have is Dr. Michael Lennox, who is one of America's most recognized and respected dream interpreters. And I didn't dream last night. Bummer. I bet you I'm going to have an awesome dream tonight. Hopefully he'll let me call him tomorrow. But, of course, you all won't know what happened. Having spent the last 20 years interpreting thousands of dreams in workshops, in the media, and for corporate and private clientele, Lennox, who holds a doctorate in psychology, has been deeply influenced by Carl Jung's theories on dreams. So I can't wait to hear what he has to say about dreams and about why we need them and where they come from and where we go with them. Well, all that being said, we're going to have him on in just a few moments. So I started to say what the interesting thing is. Well, life changes, and maybe we don't like the change that's happening. And granted, some of the changes can make us uncomfortable. But that's what we're all about here at Life Changes. You know, if you're prepared for the change, or if you're anticipating it, expecting it, or maybe even affecting it, maybe not only will it be a change in a way that you want it to be, but it will be one that actually benefits you. So the interesting thing is, I say again, that sometimes life changes, things happen, and we look at them as so bad. And then we discover that they weren't so bad after all. As a matter of fact, they might have actually been good. But the thing is, yeah, hindsight, you know, Monday morning quarterback, afterwards, we could say, oh, that was great. But if you think about it, sometimes in those moments when things happen, we go into rage or we go into fear, and our bodies go through this anger and all these endorphins are released that we go through a traumatic period, or we yell at somebody, or we hurt relationships because of some of the changes, or we ruin experiences or situations. So I'll give you an example, and it's interesting because I just recently received an email, and it just made me laugh about something that seemed so horrible at the time. So as a matter of fact, our very own producer, Mark Lejeune, was coming for a show, and he was bringing his mother for the first time to hear a live show and to see an actual taping. And I had never met his mother, none of us had, and so we were all excited about meeting his mother, and we wanted to make a good impression on her because, you know, Mark means a lot to us, and we wanted to let her know that, you know, your kid's a good kid, and we wanted to get to know her. So I prepared a really big meal for her. Her name's Ginger, by the way, which is ironic because that's the story is very much tied to that name. So I prepared this really big meal, and I was, you know, making sure that it was food that she would eat and she would like, and I decided also to make a ginger soup. And so I made a carrot ginger soup, and I've made this many times before, and every time I make it, people just tell me how wonderful it is. So I knew, I had asked Mark if she liked carrot soup and ginger soup, and he said, sure, she likes that. So I made it, and I made it extra special. I put extra ginger in it, live ginger, fresh organic ginger, very spicy ginger, but I didn't know that because I didn't eat it raw. I just stuck it in with the soup and just made it. And lo and behold, and actually I also then put some red chili peppers, which I always do, just for a little kick. What I didn't know is that the ginger soup had a big kick to begin with, and by adding the extra little red peppers made it that much kickable or kickful or something, so much so that none of us could eat it. And we just sat there like, what do we do with this? Now, of course, I had served it and I was busy preparing the next dish or something. And I came back. Nobody had eaten a thing. And I thought, well, that was polite. Everybody's waiting for me. But so I took one taste of my spoon, thinking as soon as I lift my spoon, they'll all lift their spoons and we'll all eat together. But no, I was the only one that ate because it was so spicy. I burnt my tongue and my face got red and I thought, how can they eat this? Well, they couldn't. They couldn't. And unfortunately, they had taken one bite, which had burnt their tongues, and then they weren't able to taste any of the rest of the food I made. So it wouldn't have mattered what I had worked so hard to make because our mouths were all burnt from this ginger soup that I had made. So I apologized to Mark's mother, Ginger, and I said, I'm so sorry. This has never happened before. And she said, oh, really, it's quite okay. And she was really pleasant about it, and I'm grateful for it. And if she's listening, thank you so much for not making me feel bad about it. But the thing is that every email that we get from her or every email correspondence that her son Mark sends to us every once in a while talks about that soup. And we laugh about it, and we make jokes about it. The last email I got from Ginger was, I can't wait to come back, because she lives out of town, and have that ginger soup only without the kick. And I got a kick out of that email that I wouldn't have gotten if the soup had come out perfect. And I can't say that I'm grateful that the soup came out like it did, but I'm grateful for the experience. And I'm grateful that it helped us, you know, break the ice and have a stronger, quicker bond because we were able to laugh about it. Not me so much right away, but everybody else at least, throughout the dinner. And we made fun of every dish and then it's like, oh, how spicy is this one? And it just got to be so much fun for everybody else, not exactly for me at that moment. And eventually, I came to see the humor, and obviously now I'm laughing about it and able to talk about it. But, you know, what if I had thrown caution to the wind and said, what if this is perfect? What if this is exactly what we needed to break the ice or to get to know each other better or to have something that we'll talk about for years to come and just enjoy? What if I was able to maybe not know exactly how much fun it'll be for us in the next years to come, but just allow it to be maybe perfect, maybe something that was special, maybe something that we could expect the unexpected from this moment of horror of an extra spicy ginger soup. So for that, I thank my higher self for having made a soup like that, and I thank my higher self never to make it again, to find other things that we could enjoy and play with, and not my cooking. And I thank Ginger for having taken it the way she did, and for having continued the joke, and played with all of us on it. And so, all right, you know what, come to think of it, I am grateful for it, because it has certainly brought a lot of joy. So with that, I want to remind us that maybe we can't look at every situation that happens like that right away when it happens. But maybe by not allowing ourselves to get too dramatic about it or get too negative or too serious or too worried or too fearful, maybe we could more quickly allow the fun in that maybe was waiting to happen on the other side of what it was. The fun, the lesson, the understanding, and then eventually the gratitude. So, with that, I want to remind you all that you're listening to Life Changes with Filippo, and this is Filippo Voltaggio having a great time already with you, and I'm looking for an even more great time in just a few minutes because our guest is a great time waiting to be had. He is so delightful. I enjoy speaking to him and listening to him play the piano or sing, whatever he does. It's always fun to be around our guest, Dr. Michael Lennox. Now, of course, he's here to talk about dreams. And let me tell you a little bit about him. He's got a book coming out in February that's about the interpretations of dreams, and it's called Dreamsight. And he started as a very young child, and we'll let him talk about that, but he eventually went on to study Jungian psychology, and he got a master's degree and a PhD in psychology from the California Graduate Institute. Now, he's actually pretty famous all around the world because, of course, everybody watches American television, so anybody that's watched the Sci-Fi Network's The Dream Team with Annabelle and Michael, they've seen him interpreting dreams on that. The Emmy Award-winning Starting Over show on Soaps Network's Soap Talk, MTV's Myths and Urban Legends, National Lampoon's Editorial Desk, the Wayne Brady Show. For some reason that sounds funny. Wayne Brady. I did say it right. Wayne Brady Show, as well as he's been all over on the local broadcasting network TV. Whenever something comes up, they call him and say, "What does this mean? What does this mean?" So he also writes. You might have read him in Today's Woman, or in 360, or TV Guide likes to use him. Like they used him to interpret the dreams of Sopranos character Tony Soprano. I could go on and on, actually, but we have him here, so we'll let. Oh, I do want to mention this. This is fascinating to me. I'm going to have to remember to ask him. He's worked with corporate clients, and so I'm kind of curious what the corporations want to know about dreams, like Century 21 and Carry On Communication and even the Los Angeles Masons. Like, what do they want to know about dreams? Well, he's here to tell us all that he can in the short time that we have together. Please welcome to the show, or we welcome to the show, Dr. Michael Lennox.
Hello. Hello. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. Okay, so how does someone say, oh, I'm going to become a dream interpreter?
Okay, well, I did start very young, as you said, and I think that the seminal moment for me was and as a little kid, my mother had record albums that we listened to all the time. One of them was Fiddler on the Roof.
Ah, okay.
And in Fiddler on the Roof, there's a dream sequence.
Oh.
And it's Teddy's actually making the dream up,
right,
to sort of make a point. But in the show, his wife says to him, "Tell me what you dreamed, and I'll tell you what it meant."
Uh-huh.
And that line sort of resonated in my sort of 8, 9, 10-year-old imagination as something that one could do, that you could tell someone a dream and they could tell you what it meant. Then when I was about 15 or 16, my mother was getting a degree in social work, and on her shelf I saw Freud's Interpretation of Dreams, and I picked it up, and I read it. Now, I don't think I really understood really what the book was about at 15 years old, but I did get that you could indeed analyze a dream and get some value out of it. And then as a teenager, people would say at school, like they do all over the place, "Oh, I had this crazy dream last night."
Right.
And I would say, "Tell me what you dreamed, and I'll tell you what it meant," because I was sort of ballsy, and I just thought maybe I could. And as it turned out, I could. I had this sort of quirky gift that I would listen to a dream, and I would just, things would occur to me, and I would say them. And people would go, "Wow, that makes sense." And this was happening to me as a teenager. So that by the time I became a young adult, I had read a few books, I had taken a few workshops, and I was sort of presenting myself to the world as a dream interpreter. Long before I really had any credential for it at all. But indeed, I did seem to have this gift, so that when I went to grad school later in life, it sort of all coalesced, and that's what I do today.
You know, that's interesting. Kind of an aside, you mentioned that you picked up a Freudian book on dreams.
Yes.
And then you must have dropped that altogether because you totally went Carl Jung.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Freud was an interesting fellow because he did so much for opening up psychology to the modern world, but almost everything that he really brought forth is almost sort of laughed at today. And in the dream world, his dream work to me, and this is certainly an opinion, although it's certainly widely held, is that, you know, he was so obsessed with sex. And his dream work was very reductive. He took every image and sort of reduced it to its sexual component.
Mm-hmm.
And what Jung came along, and this is why they did not stay colleagues. Jung said, sex is great, and there's a drive there, but there are other drives. There are other important motivating factors in the human condition.
Well, that's interesting because, okay, so Freud was breaking it down into sex, but doesn't Carl Jung break it down into everything in the dream is you?
Well, yes, but that's a very holistic approach. That's
true.
You know, that was what Carl Jung sort of did for psychology. He said, well, okay, there's this idea that that the self, with the small s, is at the center of our sense of who we are. And therefore, then the world at large is a reflection of us. The dream is a reflection of your psychology. And he created the idea of the collective unconscious, that there's this realm of sort of super consciousness that all human beings connect to. Mm. And so in that, he really was the first sort of metaphysicist in the psychological world by saying that, yes, not only is the dream a reflection of you and everybody and everything in the dream is a part of your psyche, but that through the dream, all human beings are connected.
Well, I understand that and I appreciate that. It just can get a little frustrating when you think you've had a dream about, this gorgeous person you want to be with and you were finally together in your dream or that your father came to you and said these amazing
things. Wonderful things that you always wanted to say.
Exactly.
But now there's,
and then
there is
you find out it's you.
But, it's not an absolute there either. There are what I call the two circles of interpretation, that the inner circle of interpretation is when you look at a dream and consider it only as a reflection of yourself. To me, this is the value of dreams and considering dreams as a kind of self-reflection tool, is to examine every person as a part of your psyche. But there's also the fact that dreams are borrowing from our lives and our relationships and our environments. So they can, in the, what I call the second circle of interpretation, which sort of goes around the first one, where dreams are sort of reflecting the shifts and changes that are happening with the people that we interact with, the relationships that we're having, and the places that we spend our time. So, yes, that dream, especially in relationships, you have a dream about the spouse. Yes, it's, part of you, but it's also a function of the relationship you're having.
Okay. All right, so let's go back a little bit. So here you were a kid, and you figured you could do this, and then you started studying this, and so you went into the science of it, which I think is interesting, because a lot of people that do dream work just come from a metaphysics sort of,
yes.
And you actually went into the science.
Yes, and in fact, I absolutely consider myself half a scientist, half a mystic, and I like inhabiting that idea of both sides of the spectrum.
I like that too. It excites both sides of my brain.
Yeah. And in fact, in Jung, who sort of created the types in the Myers-Briggs typology, introvert,
right,
extrovert, feeling, thinking, I'm a thinker on the feeling thinking scale, but a two. On that scale, I'm right smack dab in the middle,
right,
of the sort of feeling, intuiting, sort of sensitive side and the rational analytical. And so I appreciate both. And by being at the center of that, I think it's one of the ways in which I can interpret a dream is that I'm hearing it in a kind of linear fashion, but I'm experiencing it in a three-dimensional feeling kind of fashion.
Wow.
And by putting those two things together. And it's the same thing in the understanding of dreams is appreciating what we know about dreams and sleep through science and what's provable, and then understanding, too, that the mystics are always way ahead of the science.
Yeah, I like that. I'm glad you think so. I know so. Okay, so here we are. In the science realm, what are these things called dreams?
God. And in the science realm, we know very little.
Oh, wow.
We know very little about what they are. We know a bit about what they do or what they provide. And so that can be extrapolated into understanding a little bit of what they are. So let's talk about the two things that they generally, predominantly provide. One is memory formation and learning. We learn in REM sleep.
Okay.
The first studies that were done with this, you remember Tetris, the video game? We're dating ourselves, of course. That sort of early video game.
I'm going to say no.
Okay. I think he's lying.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I remember Tetris, where it's a very simple video game of, shapes, and it was a simple skill set thing. And
okay.
They did some studies to show that people improved steadily after a sleep. In other words, you could play all day, and you would improve very little from the beginning of that day to the end of that day.
Hmm.
But there would be a marked improvement between the end of the day one and the very beginning of day two.
Wow.
Which showed that the sleep process was actually incorporating what you learned the day before. This has also been borne out with college students in exams are spending more time in REM than people who are not trying to study and incorporate learning and knowledge into their brains.
And REM, of course, is rapid eye movement.
Which is the part of sleep, the stage in sleep where most dreaming is experienced. The vivid kind of dreamings that we refer to as, oh, I had a dream last night, happened in REM.
Okay, so this is the conversation that I didn't want to have with you because I'm not a really good sleeper, and I think that's...
That might be why you feel sort of dim.
Thank you. I didn't expect that kind of an analysis today.
Just curious. Wondering if you do.
So first you were dating me, making me a lot older than I actually am, and now you're telling me I'm a little dim.
Oh, dear.
But so I know it's important, but I feel like I can get a little bit more done if I just spend an extra 2 hours or whatever.
Well, and one thing that I will tell you about this, which I think is also connected to the second piece of what we know about what dreams do, is that there is a resting function, a sort of a dynamic way in which the brain offloads all the excess data that comes in for the day and sort of goes back to a neutral place so that it can wake up the next day and go about the life again, is also happening in brain. It's like a cleaning out kind of thing. You may sleep less than you desire or less than other people say they sleep, but REM is the one stage of sleep that people actually will make up. So you may sleep less, but you're spending more time in REM than you are in the other stages of sleep. And how we know this is because you're not psychotic.
Wow.
If you did not sleep and therefore were deprived of REM sleep, you would eventually have psychotic symptoms.
Wow.
The beginnings of those would be simple little things like auditory hallucinations or visual hallucinations, very mild kinds of things. If you were prone to psychosis, you would, you know, have stronger psychotic experiences.
Like if I thought you were talking to me but you really weren't even here?
Yes, exactly. And how would you know?
How do you know?
So now you're old, dumb, and crazy.
I thought it was dim. It gets
dim,
worse.
Dim, dumb, whatever.
And so we're happy we had our guest today. He had to leave early because he was a figment of my imagination anyway. Rapid eye movement, the REM stage is when the dreams happen.
Well, we dream at all stages of sleep, but that is the stage where we have the very specific kinds of dreams that people refer to as, oh, I had a dream. The dreams that happen in earlier stages of sleep are usually fuzzy and not storyline oriented. Usually when people in sleep labs are woken up in those earlier stages of sleep, they report very light sort of imagery, more feeling, sensorial kind of experiences and dreams, wow, not real storyline dreams.
So lots is really happening
during sleep. Lots. And the scientists, of course, look at the data that they have, and some of them, this is where I have an objection to science, is then they will dismiss the theoretical or the mystical or the psychological. Oh, well, we know we're learning, you're learning things and you're cleaning out your brain so you don't go psychotic, therefore nothing else is happening. But I don't believe that that's true. I believe that there is a window into the invisible side of life. And that invisible side of life contains spirit, imagination, creativity, and all of the realms of the unknown that that science is not yet able to prove exists, but that we human beings who connect to these places understand, you know, sort of intrinsically that they exist.
Okay, so we're not just tapping into what's in our head already during the dream, like our pineal gland opens up or something and we're having something happen there. You're actually saying that we're actually connecting to something else other than our own physicality.
And I would say that one day science will find out how and what the brain is doing that allows us to tap into the greater energetic experience that is beyond understanding at this moment. So yes, the pineal gland and the various neurotransmitters and chemicals that are released are absolutely being released. And when scientists sort of say, and that's what's happening, I just sort of laugh and say, no, basically what you're describing is the chemical shape of God inside the brain. That is God, or the experience of the divine, as can be described at the current level of science as the brain function. I think the soul is somewhere in the brain or through the brain.
Okay, so it's important that we have them, dreams,
yes,
because that signifies that we're going through processes that the body needs,
yes,
to go through.
Yes.
And the psyche, evidently.
Yes. Now think about this.
Okay.
If we know that you're learning in sleep, tangible, sort of cognitive facts, and we also know that through the course of a life, we attain this thing, hopefully, if we're lucky and we're paying attention, that we call wisdom. isn't it possible then that wisdom, which isn't just facts and factoids, wisdom is the synthesizing of facts, the ability to use what you've learned to make broader choices, better choices, higher level choices. That's wisdom. So if wisdom grows with age, I posit that it's happening through our dreams, that we're experiencing life out in the world, we're running into obstacles and perceived mistakes, challenges in love and intimacy, and feelings of shame and failure, all these things that we bump up against, and then we have these horrible dreams, and you know, wake up the next day sort of ready to face it all again. And I believe that in the process of opening that doorway to the deeper psyche through the dream process, we're actually growing wiser just by staying on the planet longer. And that dream work, and the reason why I'm such a proponent of it, is just increasing the value that can be gotten from that natural organic experience that's happening whether you remember the dream or not.
Okay, so before we move on, though, let me just clarify something. It's not the case that like people who like to sleep a lot, like more than 8 hours, more than 12 hours, it's not the case that necessarily they're getting wiser.
Yeah, no, I would call that depression.
Okay.
No, I think that, you know, that, no, more sleep isn't going to equate to more wisdom. It's okay. Going to equate to less time awake.
Okay. All right, so... So, actually, this is probably a good time to break and let everybody know that you're listening to Life Changes with Filippo on the BBS Radio Network here every Monday night at 7 p.m. And to learn more about our show and our current guests and our future guests, for that matter, our past guests as well, you can go to lifechanges.ws. And currently, you can hear all of our archived shows in their entirety for free. Want to remind everybody also that you're listening to our guest, Dr. Michael Lennox. And you can learn more about him, of course, at our website, but also at his website, dreaminterpretation.com.
It's dreaming interpretation.
Oh, that is dreaming interpretation. I've got it written down as dreaming. I don't sleep enough. That's what it is. dreaminterpretation.com and michaellennox.com. And Lennox is spelled L-E-N-N-O-X. Unless I got that wrong, too. No.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Correct.
And he's got a book coming out on Llewellyn Press in February, and it's going to be called Dream Sight, in which he talks about dream interpretation on many different levels. So back with our guest now, you've told us that scientifically there's a reason, and science don't know too much about it and all that, and that you just before the break said that we grow from it, acquire wisdom from it, and process whether we remember or not.
Yes.
So is it important to remember?
I do believe that it is. I really, really do. I wouldn't have devoted my life to it. Listen, I'm subject to hyperbole. Everything is the biggest, the greatest, the most wonderful experience ever. You know, it's extraordinary. This is like a friend of mine likes to tease me, I'm always saying. However, hyperbole aside, I really do believe that of all the tools that are out there for self-investigation and awareness and having a better experience, a broader experience of oneself, I do believe the dreams offer the most bang for the buck, if you will, the most value for the time spent in terms of things that you can do to pay attention to who you are and how you're showing up in the world. I think dreams absolutely offer the most value that one can get, and they're for fun and they're for free.
For fun and for free. I like that. Well, actually, for fun. That's a really interesting comment, because some people dream, or some of our dreams, are not fun at all.
Absolutely. Actually, you're right.
And we can't move, we can't talk, we can't scream, and we've got big ugly monsters coming to us. And
yes.
What's up? That's not fun.
Well, no, actually, you're right. That is not fun, but valuable. You sort of mentioned two different possibilities there. One, which is sort of the sleep paralysis and the night terrors, and we can talk about that. And then there's just nightmares. People will ask me frequently, well, why do we have nightmares? And there's a sort of a short pat answer to that question, which is I think that when we have a nightmare, it's because our unconscious mind is trying to get our attention, and something that we remember, something that we're vibrantly sort of present for, like a scary image, is one really effective way of getting our attention and having us remember. What I experience with people that I work with is frequently people want to talk to me because they're having a nightmare, and it's very upsetting and disturbing. And when we look at the universal meaning behind the symbols in the nightmare, A, the nightmares go away, and B, we find out that the unconscious mind isn't really trying to terrify us, and in fact that the scary content of the dream isn't really about the scary things that are being presented, but symbolic meaning best presented in those scary images.
Hmm. Okay.
Okay. All right. I'll give you an example. All right, you're still scared. I'll give you an example. This is my sort of favorite example that I've used a lot. This wonderful woman called me a number of years ago. She was in her early 20s, and she was having nightmares of giving birth to babies and then murdering them in very sort of ghastly, violent, bloody fashion. And she was having this dream recurring over a period of several weeks. And she was really very upset about this dream because she, as many people will believe when they're having a disturbing dream, that the thing that disturbs them about the dream is what they think it means.
Like a death or a...
Right, right. Oh my God, I'm going to die because I dreamed I was going to die. Or Grandma Rose is going to die because she died in my dream. Or I'm going to become a sort of a homicidal mother the moment I have kids because this dream obviously is showing me that I have these terrible tendencies that are living deep inside my psyche, which truly was not the case. When we began to talk, I asked her a couple of questions about her life and her creative expression, and indeed she was a writer. And yes, and I asked her, was she working on anything at the moment that she was having all the dreams? And yes, she was. She was throwing out first drafts of a project. There was a deadline coming up, and she was always sort of, you know, consecutively unhappy about what she was creating and having to throw out a draft. And indeed, these dreams were coinciding, that the baby in her dreams that she was birthing was a symbolic baby. Anything that's young is sort of in potential. It's new.
Mm-hmm.
And the babies in her dream were her little, the babies of her little drafts. And having to toss out a draft that didn't suit her was a little bit like murdering one of her dear ones.
Wow.
And as soon as she heard that possibility of the universal meaning of these symbols, we were on the phone. She was several thousand miles away, but I could literally hear the aha sort of like crackle through the phone line.
Interesting.
And her whole tonality changed, and she became so relaxed. And of course, I heard later that not only did the nightmare stop, but she, very soon after the session that we had, came upon the draft that she was comfortable and satisfied with. That the looping in the fear thing was really keeping blocking her creativity.
So in this case, not only the dream, but the understanding and interpretation of
yes.
it helped
yes.
in her real life.
And the recurrence of the dream was right. because she wasn't opening up to the thing that her unconscious was trying to communicate to
yeah.
her.
Yeah. Okay, and all that being said, sometimes Grandma Rose does die after dying in a dream.
Absolutely.
What
and
is that?
Yes, there is a thing called precognitive dreaming. People who have that experience are prone to having it. I think that there's like a segment of the population. I think it's an intuitive sort of an ability that certain people have. And I think this also speaks to some things we chatted about a little earlier, about the notion that there is this invisible side to life, this sort of energetic place where we're all connected that we don't really understand, and that people who are open to metaphysics sort of have a sensibility about that's more accepting. So that, yeah, if there's a deep connection between one person and another, especially if that deep connection connects through biology and genealogy, that when one of them is passing away, that's a very big energetic change. And that energetic ripple in the grid of life over there might be in the, you know, sort of the spectrum of sleep vibrating over here with the sleeper and the dreamer as a visitation in a dream. I've heard this.
Wow.
I've heard this enough times from people who report it as, not only do they report it as something that they vibrantly believe in, they all report the experience in the same way. The way the dreams feel, the sort of context and content, the way they appear, the person who's passed usually just sort of appears.
Mm-hmm.
There's no speaking. There's no other scenarios. They just sort of sit on the bed. It's like, oh, I was in my room, and I was dreaming that I was in my room, and Grandma Rose sat on the bed, and she smiled, and that was it. And then I found out, you know, later that day or the next day that she had passed away. I've heard that a version of that story, you know, 200 times in the last 15 years.
Well,
so that's enough for me to say it exists.
It's enough for you, but it's not enough for science, right?
Well, it's not provable or repeatable by the scientific method.
Mm.
So me hearing a dream from another person isn't exactly scientific data. I could be lying. They could be lying. That's what science would say. And, of course, that's true. So, but if you take away the constructs of science that have to be in a sort of laboratory, you know, testable, that's empirical evidence for me, but not yet for science until someday that, you know, something like that could be measured, you know, by energetic shifts and changes. You know, you could sort of hit, soak somebody up to electrodes in a sleep lab and then kill their grandmother, but that would be unethical.
I can't imagine you just said that. You must be a figment of my imagination. Actually, no, I'm glad that you're not, because I'd hate to think that my imagination does that, but actually that my imagination would do that. But having said that, it's interesting. How does one, to use your horrible yet very effective dream analogy, how does one know whether they're going to kill babies or it means that you're actually killing the drafts that you're writing?
Well, that's a good question. Truthfully, if in your sort of mid to late 20s you were going to kill babies, you'd already know it.
Okay.
You're dangerously
what if you're
off
latent,
course here.
A latent
homicidal maniac. You know, what I think I can sort of comfortably say and stand by in terms of responding to that question is that if there's one experience that I've had over and over and over again, it's watching a person who's had a dream that's disturbed them listen to what I say a dream might mean by virtue of giving them some universal meaning associated with the symbols that the dream contains, and watching the relief sort of spread across their, you know, their face and go, aha, that I believe in that process because I've seen it happen so many times where people go, oh, wow, that makes so much sense. That's the phrase I hear a lot. That makes so much sense.
Okay, so when something aligns, when something resonates, when it feels true or right, it doesn't feel true that somebody's going to go out and do such and such, but when you make
the interpretation through the universal symbolism, it resonates. And, you know, in fact, that experience is what led me down the path to devote my life to dreams. Huh. It's that experience of the aha. That experience is incredibly satisfying to me because then it becomes about the information that's in the dream. It's not something that I'm doing. You know, it feels good that I can do it. Yes, it's fun. I enjoy it. And, it makes me feel good. But it's not me doing it. It's the universal information that's in the dream. And that relief and that recognition is just joyful.
Yeah, connecting the dots. Well, you know, as I mentioned before, I don't remember a dream that I had last night. And it's very unfortunate because knowing you were going to be on the show, it would have been great to have a dream that you could interpret for me. But when Dorothy Lee Donahue, our producer, when her daughter found out you were going to be on the show and saw you on the website, she wrote me this, and I had to make sure that she was being serious.
Okay.
And then I had to ask her mother and make sure that it was okay that I read this on the air. But here she is. She's writing, "Hi, Filippo. During your live interview tonight, ask what it means when you dream that your mother is running around in a tube top style strapless sundress in all her glory, because that is what I dreamt about last night."
Oh.
So what could that possibly mean? And do we want to know? Or do we want to share it with everybody?
Well, okay, and Dorothy has given permission.
Okay,
so the dreamer wants to know, and the person, the object of the dream, is given permission. Well,
and of course, Carl Jung would say this is really her running around.
Right. This is absolutely an aspect. Now, this is a mother and daughter, which means that if she had feelings about this experience of her mother running around in the tube top, that it could connect to feelings that she has about her mother out and about in the world that might be impacting her sort of sensibility. But on the more valuable front, it's a dream about a sense of availability to inner nurturing.
Really? I never would have gotten that.
Well, what do tube tops cover?
Breasts.
What are breasts? The source of mother's milk. And this is a literal mother. So we're really talking about the first meals.
Wow.
Okay, so we're talking about, and tube tops, they can be
yanked
right down.
So it's a dream about food. I love that.
Well, it's a dream about nutrients, okay. Not food per se. Well, it's right. A dream about having access and quick and ready access. You yank that tube top down, and there the breasts are ready to be proffered as nurturance.
Wow.
And mothering, the feminine principle in all its glory. That's the thing, and this is why, where I go, you know, why I get that is that that's the one thing that you would ever, you know, I remember when tube tops were in, and it was sort of delightful for us adolescent
boys. I don't remember that.
But. Yeah, I know, because you're not quite as old as I am. But when I was a boy and they were in, you know, if you could get close up to the, you know, the unfortunate girl wearing a tube top, you know, the object was to yank it down, revealing, you know, the breast. So in this dream, we're talking about a daughter dreaming about a mother and having access to those breasts so that within her own psyche, you know, once we internalize our parents in the character aspect world, then dreaming of a mother, dreaming of someone's mother is about the internal mother.
Okay.
As we were mothered, so we then mother. And so this is a dream about having, you know, quick and ready access to some level of nurturing. Now, if she were here, I would want to ask more questions about how did the dream feel? How did she feel about this, you know, the mother? You know, there's language in there running around in all her glory.
In all her glory,
now,
yeah.
Now, there's the possibility that there's some, you know, that phrase, is it sort of a right phrase, in all her glory? Does she mean that in a celebratory way? Does she mean that in a, oh, God, you know, sort of, oh, she's in her all her glory? You know, I don't know, you know. So these are important distinctions to make. And then I would be asking her about, you know, what is going on in her life that might be upping the ante for need of self-care.
Wow. Yeah, and I'm a little intuitive myself, and I'd like to say that what I'm picking up is stop dreaming about your mother's breasts. There's something not right about that. So yeah, that's it. The channel
opened, out the cave, the channel's closed, and it's done.
Well, thank you for helping us understand that one. I'm kind of glad I didn't dream or remembered it, because that was kind of fun. And I don't know that I would have dreamed that. So, anyway, I'm having so much fun, and I'm gathering that there is a sense of fun that you experience around this work.
Oh, my Lord. It is so much. Well, I mean, and clearly I like to laugh, and I like to, you know, be in that sort of childlike wonder kind of energy, and dreams offer that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when people are sharing their dreams, whether it's one-on-one or on a group level, whether they know it or not, until we sort of get going, you know, that they're also opening themselves to sort of that state of wonder the dreams have to offer. So, yes, I love it. You know, I'll go to a party or event, and people will say, oh, God, you probably don't want, you know, me to. It's like, no, anytime. Anytime.
Oh, really? I'm calling you tomorrow because I know
okay.
I'm going to dream tonight.
No, it's something that I do truly love, and I feel incredibly blessed to be able to have sort of looked at my life, you know, 10, 15 years ago and said, okay, what's wrong with this picture? I was very successful in the entertainment industry. I was making a good living, but my soul was sort of being depleted. And, you know, the dream thing was always there. And that's why I went to grad school, to make it, you know, sort of all of my life. And literally the minute that I finished with my master's and before I had the doctorate, the media was calling and things were moving.
You were definitely on the right path.
Yeah.
Well, we just got a couple more minutes left, and I have a question that's burning inside my mind. In your opinion, whether from your scientific mind, well, probably not your scientific mind, but your more mystic side, are there some experiences that happen during sleep that are not dreams that actually are happening, like an astral projection or a...
Ah, good question. Great question. And this is a wonderful... This show and your topic, you know, your bent, it really sort of allows
and
me
now
to
get... You're saying I'm bent. You know, this is such a pleasure. Is there anything else you'd like to tell my audience about me?
Golly.
No. Have me on your show sometime.
Yeah. Okay. So, interesting that, okay. Earlier you talked about paralysis and,
right.
and not being, there is a state, the technical name is hypnagogic or hypnopompic hallucinations. Nice big word. The simple sort of state is night terrors. What happens in that state physiologically is that when we're in REM sleep, our brain paralyzes our body. It does this to protect it. Our frontal cortexes are firing at a rapid rate, and if we were not paralyzed, we would be running around acting out our dreams.
Oh, wow, like so, like physically punching somebody out.
Oh,
you
would
with
be
your,
doing, yeah, ever yeah, watch yeah. a dog? A dog, we know the dog is dreaming because their leg is sort of, you know,
right.
kicking in that cute little way. Well, that's because they are running around the field chasing, you know, cars.
Oh, wow.
Maybe not the field, you know, wherever their cars are. But they're paralyzed, so they can't really do it, so there's a little bit of movement. Same thing with talking in the sleep or being restless in the sleep.
Wow.
You're being activated by the frontal cortex kicking out, you know, off with lots of neural firings, but you're paralyzed, you can't move. Well, the brain is designed such that when dreaming is over and REM is completed, that the paralysis lifts and consciousness returns. Sometimes it doesn't quite happen that way, and consciousness will lift before the paralysis is let go of the grip that it has on the body. When that happens, you have a night terror. You dream. You think you're dreaming, and in all you know intents and purposes, you are. But the dream is that you're in your room, in your bed, unable to move, unable perhaps to breathe or scream. And very often there's a feeling and a sense that there's a presence, usually a malevolent presence, in the room, sometimes even sitting on one's chest. This is the way people report this.
Or experience. On the back?
I suppose. I guess so. Sitting on you, keeping you locked down. Okay, so if there is this... I've also heard people talk about being in that state and consciously maneuvering away from a malevolent presence to a beautiful presence. I have a belief, this is absolutely not backed up with any kind of research, but a belief that when the semi-conscious state is there, you're still half unconscious, which means that the doorway to this invisible plane of reality is still wide open, but you're still a little bit conscious enough to perceive the room.
Okay.
That the presence is that there's always presence around us that we cannot perceive as human beings, that some more sensitive people can periodically perceive energy or information or qualities of movement in this sort of present state in the room, that we're wide open to that phenomenon, but because we're paralyzed and can't breathe, we're terrified, so we imbue the presence with malevolence.
Mm.
People who claim to have been abducted by aliens report the same kind of experiences as night terrors, only to like the nth degree. So I do believe that there is some availability to planes of existence and reality that we cannot perceive in our waking states are available to us in this semi-conscious state. And I've heard enough people sort of working with that state in interesting ways that make me believe in that. For instance, someone who had chronic night terrors and eventually began to, through meditation and being present for that paralysis but not, you know, moving away from the terror, was actually able to create a sense of a very beautiful being present with him in the room over time.
Well, this has actually been a wonderful dream, as if I had a beautiful presence in the room with me. And I really do
like it,
but I feel like waking up and coming back to reality, because we only have a few more minutes left in the show, and we've got another segment to get to, but it has truly been a pleasure
having you on.
It's
been an absolute delight.
You are the delight, my friend. We've been talking to Dr. Michael Lennox, and you can learn more about him at dreaminginterpretation.com or at michaellennox.com. He's got a book coming out in February called Dream Sight, and it's on the Llewellyn Press.
Oh, okay, thank you.
And he noticed I was able to say it before without any problems. It's interesting. It's getting late, and I'm not thinking of sleeping. And you also, you work privately, one-on-one with people, you work with groups, and you work with corporations, which we didn't get to talk about. But unfortunately, I'm going to have to leave us all suspended on what the corporations want to know about dreams, and hope to have you back sooner at a live event or something, because you've been just a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Been great to be here.
Dr. Michael Lennox, thank you so much. So with that, I'd like to bring on our final segment of the show. It's Dorothy Lee Donahue with How to Be the Change You Wish to See in the World.
Hi. What a great show. And somehow I missed the segment about my daughter.
Oh, it was great. You'll have to listen to the archive.
I'm sure I will. I'm going to share about a different kind of dream, the kind of dreams Martin Luther King spoke of when he said, "I have a dream." Long before Martin Luther King, another incredible Latin African American had a dream. She was Harriet Tubman, an abolitionist, humanitarian, and Union spy during the American Civil War. She dreamed of freedom. Freedom not only for herself, but for everyone. After escaping from slavery into which she was born, she made 13 missions to rescue over 70 slaves, using the network of anti-slavery activists and safe houses known as the Underground Railroad. She later helped John Brown recruit men for his raid on Harper's Ferry, and in the post-war era, struggled for women's suffrage. As a child in Maryland, Tubman was beaten and whipped by various masters to whom she'd been hired out. Early in her life, she suffered a traumatic head wound when she was hit by a heavy metal weight thrown by an irate overseer. The injury caused disabling seizures, headaches, powerful visionary and dream activity, which occurred throughout her entire life. A devout Christian, she described her visions and vivid dreams as messages from God. She overcame what most would have allowed to cripple them for life. In 1849, at the age of 29, she escaped to Philadelphia, then immediately returned to Maryland to rescue her family. Slowly, one group at a time, she brought relatives with her out of the state and eventually guided dozens of other slaves to freedom. Traveling by night and in extreme secrecy, Tubman, or Moses as she was called, never lost a passenger, as she later put it, at women's suffrage meetings. Large rewards were offered for the capture and return of many of the people she helped escape, but no one ever knew it was Harriet who was helping them. When the far-reaching United States Fugitive Slave Law was passed in 1850, she helped guide fugitives further north into Canada and helped newly freed slaves find work. When the American Civil War began, she worked for the Union Army, first as a cook and nurse, and then as an armed scout and spy. The first woman to lead an armed expedition in the war, she guided the Combahee River Raid, which liberated more than 700 slaves. After the war, she retired to the family home in New York, where she cared for her aging parents. She was active in the women's suffrage movement until illness overtook her and she had to be admitted to a home for elderly African Americans she had helped open years earlier. Against all odds, Harriet lived her dreams. She chose to become a heroine and rise above her traumatic childhood. She used her dreams to free hundreds of other slaves, and she used her dreams to build a place for her to live in when she could no longer care for herself. Harriet had this to say about dreams. Every great dream begins with a dreamer. Always remember, you have within you the strength, the patience and the passion to reach for the stars to change the world. She did indeed become the change she wished to see. She also changed the world for millions of others and has inspired generations to become the change they want to see in this world. If you haven't found your dream, now is the time to do so. Each of us incarnate with a distinct gift and purpose. We choose our parents from our soul family and ask to experience certain things so we can become who we've come here to be. We choose our names and our birth dates so we bring in certain numerical vibrations. We know what it is we're to do before we are born, but we forget because we pass through the veil of forgetfulness. However, the veils are thinning with the shift, and now is the time to remember who we are and what we have come to do. Ask yourself what it is that makes your heart sing. Ask what you would be doing if you could not fail. Find your dream and begin manifesting it now. Until next week, please remember that you are the power in your world. You are the guru you've been waiting and looking for. You're the only one who can end your suffering. And you can do this by beginning a love affair with yourself. Choose to become a very conscious co-creator by making the most elegant choices possible. And never forget that you are powerful beyond measure and that you are love, you are lovable, and you are love.
Thank you, Dorothy Lee Donahue, with How to Be the Change You Wish to See in the World. That was actually really beautiful and very touching. Wow, this has been a great show, and so much here to digest. We all need to get some sleep so that we could digest this show, and digest our lives, and be able to process it in our dreams and come out better, smarter, happier, more adjusted on the other side. Okay, so I've learned something, and I've grown from this experience, and so my life has changed. And with that, I thank you all, really, all you listeners, for being the actually part of the reason for why we're doing this. This so much is because of you all that I enjoy sharing my stories, and that we enjoy bringing such fascinating guests to help inspire, share information. You know, we are all students and we are all teachers, and at different times in our lives we either have something to share or something to learn, and that can change from moment to moment each day. And so, as the Zen Buddhists say, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. So let's be looking for the teacher at every turn, and recognize that we are the teachers for other people's turns when they look towards us for answers. Well, with that, I want to thank you all for being with us today. I'm grateful to our guest for being with us today, Dr. Michael Lennox, and remind you to look at our website to hear the archive show again or to send it to your friends. Next week we have a dear friend of mine, Laura De Leon, who's got a wonderful project for children, a project for adults that she's doing. She's a mystic herself, and she's a life coach and has a company called Mystic Muse that does some very special things with and for people. So listen in for that show next week. And I want to remind everybody that this show is made possible in part by our sponsors, Dorothy Lee Donahue and Love and Miracles, and Ion Ways Water Systems. Change your water, change your life. I am Filippo Voltaggio, and it has been a pleasure being of service tonight by hosting Life Changes with Filippo here on the BBS Radio Network. I, along with our segment hosts and producers, Dorothy Lee Donahue and Mark Lejour, and our engineer, Seth Hendricks, thank you for being part of the show and part of the change we all wish to see in the world. Ciao, everyone.
You have been listening to Life Changes with the Master of Change, Filippo Voltaggio. Join us here every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and visit us on the web at www.lifechanges.ws. Also, you can follow our community on Facebook at Life Changes. Once again, join us here next week as we consciously explore and embrace the only constant, life changes.